Serge Tankian is an Armenian writer, painter, activist, and musician, best known for his work as lyricist and frontman for System of a Down, but you certainly shouldn't sleep on his solo material or film scoring either, and he's sharing the story and philosophies of his unique life in his first book, titled Down with the System, a memoir of sorts. Serge, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Good, Trey. How are you doing, buddy?
I am great, and it is an honor and pleasure to get to speak with you now, not just as somebody who is a longtime fan of your music, but I am actually part Armenian. I am more Armenian than anything else, believe it or not. Despite the blonde hair and blue eyes, on my mother's side, my grandfather is full-born Armenian, and just learning stories of our family's history, going back to my great-great-grandparents, much like your extended family as an Armenian, we had to escape genocide in Turkey in the early 1900s. It included one of my family members, a female family member, having to dress up like a male Turkish soldier to escape the country and ultimately to rejoin her family elsewhere in Europe and then in the United States. And thankfully they did. All my great-great-grandparents were able to escape with my great-grandparents, and then they eventually had my granddad, and the rest is history, I guess. So for you, as somebody who used this book to tell your story and also your life philosophies, but also tell your family history and explain the history of the Armenian Genocide, what did your family have to go through in escaping the Armenian Genocide in the early 1900s?
Thanks for sharing that with me, man. My grandparents were survivors of the genocide, obviously. We wouldn't be around otherwise. From different parts of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire at the time. My grandfather, mostly from central Turkey, though, and they each have their own survival stories, which I've written in the book. But we knew more about my maternal grandfather, Stepan, than anyone else, because he lived longer and he was able to really tell his stories to us, you know, and some of the suffering that they saw, some of the things they witnessed. My grandfather, you know, saw his dad taken away by Turkish gendarme in front of his eyes, and he ran to the local, you know, prison where his dad was being held, and he tried to touch him, you know, and he couldn't. And his dad's like, "Don't worry, I'll be there soon. I'll be there soon." And that's the last he saw of him. My great grandfather, my grandfather's dad, pretended to be a Turk so that they wouldn't catch him. Very similar to your story. He had gone to the U.S. and come back. And after he came back, they pretended that he was a Turkish man that would come and visit the house. And one time my great grandmother apparently tried to, you know, spank my grandfather for doing something wrong at the dinner table. And that man said, "Don't," and held her hand. And soon thereafter, she confessed to him that this is your father. We just say that so that he can be saved. And just these stories are just heart-wrenching, you know. For those that don't know anything about the Armenian Genocide, it happened during World War I. 1.5 million Armenians, Greeks, and Assyrians were massacred by the Ottoman government, the Ottoman Turkish government. Turkey, until today, not only denies that it was an intentional, you know, genocide, but they also threaten current modern-day Armenia with the continuation of such devastation and, you know, atrocities along with Azerbaijan. It's really sad that this chapter of world history, not just our history, but world history, hasn't come to a just close.
It's so strange because just 30 years later, you obviously have the Holocaust that happens during World War II, and that is understandably talked about ad nauseum. I mean, you would assume that something that happens so close that also points out human atrocities to ensure that we never do those sorts of things again get swept under the rug. But sadly, as you get into the book, and we're not going to get too much deeper into it right now, there's a huge political and military element at play with all of this, including here in the U.S., despite things have changed in the last 5 years now. It's just sad that we can't just be completely honest about our history in an effort to try and avoid repeating things. So all four of your grandparents do survive the genocide, as we talked about, moving. You were eventually born in Beirut, Lebanon, in 1967, before moving to California at the age of seven. as Lebanon was plunging into a civil war. What was it like spending your early childhood in the middle of a civil war like that in 1975?
1975 is when the civil war just started. So we were one of the lucky ones to leave quickly and early. My dad was working on, you know, immigrating to the U.S. since 1972, if I'm not mistaken. So we had kind of, you know, we were a bit ahead. So we didn't see so much of the war. I remember my childhood in Lebanon, going to school. I went to a small Armenian school there as well in Beirut, and my grandparents' house and some wonderful things as a child. And then, you know, the last 6 months was war. I don't think we left the house much at all. And we were, you know, I remember specifically ducking in our room as bombs were falling and the sound of explosions and stuff, really scary for kids. You know, and it's sad to say that there are bombs falling today as we speak, you know, in Palestine, in different parts of the world, in Israel as well, from, you know, Hamas. And, you know, and as a child that is not party to any political ideology, not no nationalism as a child, a pure child, you know, the sound of a bomb and the fear that's ingrained with this randomness of killing is just something that you can't wipe away, you know?
Yeah, it's understandable that as an adult, you try and find the peaceful solution whenever possible and avoid war at all costs as well. I like you, try to be team human. These things get so complicated and nuanced, though, but at the end of the day, when you're talking about people killing people, it always seems like there is a better solution, right?
Absolutely. I, you know, it's just, unfortunately, countries act like six-year-old children with each other. They're just interested in resource acquisition and me getting my way, me doing, you know, I want this, I want that. You know, it's not, that's how countries act with each other, even civilized democratic countries, you know. It's just, it's unbelievable that as a society, you know, our technology is evolving, our logic should be evolving, you know, our medicine's evolving, and yet our base human fear and fight or flight is devolving. Like, we're worse than we were, as far as I'm concerned, you know? And that sucks, because we're looking at our own planetary annihilation in the process, you know?
Yeah,
very fucking depressing of a podcast.
Now, very, very sad indeed. But it is interesting that you were growing up as an immigrant kid in the U.S. in the mid to late 70s into the early to mid 1980s as well. How did that benefit you in the long term, Serge?
Well, I mean, I remember, I mean, writing the book brought about a lot of my memories coming to the U.S., coming to L.A. specifically. And, you know, in the 1970s, man, it was like, you know, you had hippies and a lot of color and, you know, we lived in Hollywood, you know, which is Little Armenia now, and hookers and pimps and like so much going on. Incredible music, a lot of soul music, a lot of beautiful music. My uncle had this incredible vinyl collection. And so I remember the music. I remember the TV shows like Hawaii Five-0, the original, you know, SWAT, and the music from those shows and stuff like that. Saturday Night Live. And, you know, it was a very unique era of culture, you know, that kind of changed in the 80s, if you, you know, vibe wise. And I'm very grateful because, look, I ended up in the entertainment. I didn't know I was going to be a musician or an artist. I didn't know until my 20s, you know, after university and all that. But by luck, I'm in one of the entertainment capitals in the world, and I'm grateful that I am, to be able to have achieved what we achieved as a band.
Now, the classic American immigrant story, whether people realize it or not, is not just learning the language, it's learning the language through American sitcoms. Were you learning the language through the Hawaii Five-0s and whatnot that you were watching in the 90s?
Probably. I mean, I'm, you know, it's hard to reflect now, but probably, you know, because my English was pretty bad when we came from Lebanon. And it took me probably about 3-4 months, maybe a little longer, to go from, you know, substandard English language to normal class level. You know, my math was stronger. I remember that. I started in third grade, second or third grade, when we migrated. It was very interesting. There was fear at first, because, you know, you don't know the language and you're in a different place. But that normalizes after a while. Children are resilient and pliable, you know, and it normalizes after a while. Yeah.
Yeah, you said pliable. Plasticity was a thought going through my head, especially as it pertains to learning languages. It's why we're told repeatedly as parents to teach your kids other languages at a really young age, because they will be able to learn quickly and they may have a little bit less of an accent than you would learning as an adult, for whatever that's worth.
What is it? They can learn seven languages up to the age of seven or something like that. And it helps fire the neurons left and right, like more effectively, and just makes them smarter. Knowing more languages makes them smarter.
No question. No question. Now, yeah. You just mentioned that you really didn't find that passion for music until after you had graduated college. You'd been working for your uncle's jewelry company for a couple of years, developed a software that would actually really benefit you after you started pursuing music. But was there some sort of epiphany or moment that led you to understanding that your passion was the pursuit of music and ultimately deciding to do so?
Absolutely. I describe it in detail in the book. I was working at my uncle's place in downtown Los Angeles, the jewelry district. And I, you know, I gathered that this was not going to be a long-term career for me because my heart wasn't into it, even though I was very involved and in the business. And so I thought to myself, maybe I'll be a lawyer. You know, my parents were undergoing a huge civil lawsuit at the time, and I was doing a lot of the translating and explaining and, you know, kind of dealing with lawyers. So I'm like, I'm in the middle of it anyway. I'm, you know, reading all these briefs and learning about law firsthand, unfortunately. So I might as well be a lawyer. So I signed up for these lessons where you go and learn how to take the LSAT, which is the test that you take to go to law school. And after a long day of work, I drove my Jeep Wrangler at the time to Long Beach to take one of these classes. And, you know, I was in a big class of a lot of excited young people that wanted to be lawyers, that loved the law, and they were happy to be there. And I was fucking miserable. Like, I hated it. I hated lawyers. I hated what was happening to my family with the lawsuit and all that. And I just, on the way back home, it was just like, what am I doing? Like, I'm going to the far reaches of who I should not be. And then an epiphany came, and I'm like, fuck that. I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be a musician. You know, I had to push myself to the far reaches of who I'm not, to admit to myself who I am. And the reason for that is music is a very, you know, it's not one that can guarantee success, you know, as far as income. And at the time, I was helping support my family, my parents, who had pretty much lost everything. So it was a major dive, you know. But once I realized that that was my calling, then I pivoted my life and created a bridge for myself by starting a software company so I could be my own boss and have my own hours and, you know, enhance my art and music. So it was a long road even then, but eventually got there.
By the same token, you joined a band called Soil, where you guys obviously don't make it more than a couple of years, but you do meet Darren during Soil's time as a band, and ultimately that turns into System of a Down. As System was starting to experience some mild success in the mid-1990s, you were also running a very successful software company, and it led to another crossroads moment for you. How was your dad really helpful with some invaluable advice right here to help you understand how to move forward with things?
So my dad sang and played music when he was young, but he was never, his dad died when he was in second grade. So he had to kind of get out, leave school in second grade and start working. And he was never able to pursue his musical passions. And so at one point while running the software company, I had a conundrum because it started doing well and it was taking more of my time, therefore less time to do music. Now my own company became my enemy in terms of doing music. So he saw me grappling with that conundrum one day and he asked what's going on. And I told him, and at the time he was working, he had lost his company. He had lost, you know, pretty much everything. We had real estate and many things, and he was working for a company. And he said, son, I had to give up on my dream to do music. I don't want you to do the same. If I have to get a second job, we'll make it work. Just go for it, you know? And that meant a lot to me. It gave me a lot of wind in my sails and I couldn't fail, you know? And so that meant the world to me. So when he retired and we made a record in Armenian for him, his own record, which was beautiful. It's called Inchpes Moranank, which means how can we forget? And so, yeah, that's the story.
And as far as system goes, you and Darren, you talk about adding a couple of guys that, of course, does include Shavo and then Andy, who is the original drummer, of course. And in deciding on a band name, you guys initially went with Victims of a Down, but ultimately end up changing it to System of a Down, of course, which you wholly admit in this book doesn't really mean anything. But you guys did create a sort of meaning for that phrase over time. So what does the phrase System of a Down mean to you now, Serge?
Minor correction. The band was never called Victims of a Down. Darren had a poem called Victims of a Down. And he said, this sounds really good, but I don't like the word victims. And I remember us going, well, let's change it. And we changed it to System of a Down. So the band was always called System of a Down, just to be clear.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Your question is, what was your question? Now I lost the question.
That's okay. What does the phrase System of a Down mean to you now?
It means many things to me. I mean, it's my partnership with these incredible guys that I've known for 30 years and worked with. It is a, it's been my kind of flag for anti-establishment kind of truths that I've spewed out over 30 years. It is so many things. It's family, you know, it's like a home in a way, you know, that no matter our creative differences or our vision in terms of seeing the band forward, it's home in a way.
It also had to have been a pretty huge honor when Rick Rubin decided that you guys were going to be the first band that he signed after moving American Recordings to Columbia. What was it like working with the legend Rick Rubin, who was already a legend by that point in time as well, much less everything he's done since then?
Yeah, Rick saw us play at the Viper Room in Hollywood, and he was laughing his ass off, which I really appreciated because it means he got the band's over-the-top kind of attitude and theatrics and all of that stuff. And I remember having a small chat afterwards outside, and really, and I wasn't a very assertive, or I was very shy, but I said, would you ever consider producing us, you know, immediately? And so we started the conversation at that time, and he ended up being our label head and producer for many years. And the relationship has been incredible. You know, I mean, it is thanks to Rick that Columbia, I think, had the wherewithal to allow us to go on tour for many years and, you know, win one fan over at a time and spend that money on tour support until they could see some revenue from actual sales and whatnot. Without someone like Rick that they would confide in, it would be hard for a young punk metal band to have that kind of support and patience from a major label, right? So there's a lot of things that Rick's kind of working with us helped, and his production, of course. Like his ideas are usually just get to the essence of a song, find the strength of a song, and try to, you know, multiply that strength, you know. Just an amazing person.
Yeah, I don't know if you've read his book that came out last year, but I've read
yes.
that. I see some of the creative philosophies that that you expressed in your book that he expressed in that one as well, with regards to there being a creative in all of us and really letting the creativity come to you at times versus trying to force it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love his book. I love being able to read like 10 words and then just sit with it, because it's like written like that, like a philosophy book with minimalism at heart, and just really powerful, you know, powerful statements. Yeah, we've talked about it. I was just recently on his podcast, Tetragrammaton, that's coming out soon as well. But yeah, he's so curious as a person. Like, he loves to learn things every day, something new every day, and get deep into it. I mean, that's why he started the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. And had to have been pretty cool smoking a J with Tom Petty in his place at one point as well. People are just going to have to read the book to hear any more about that.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
The self-titled album comes out in 1998. Toxicity comes out in 2001. In between then, you actually visit Armenia for the very first time in 2000. How did that trip change you, Serge?
It was my first trip to Armenia, and I, you know, had all these mystical things in my mind about what Armenia meant, you know, based on our grandparents' story. But modern day Armenia was different, you know, post-Soviet, and they were still grappling with some of the heavy kind of corruption and you know, some of the things that the Soviet legacy left them. But nonetheless, it was beautiful. And I got to go to Nagorno-Karabakh, which we call Artsakh in Armenian, for the first time then as well. And I was just amazed by the countryside, by the people. I felt, you know, at the time, nobody really knew who I was because the band was still very young. And so it was kind of, I went around very freely and enjoyed the country, went to the sites, saw Gerard, the monastery, and Garni, the ancient temple, and just really took in the sights. And it had, for a place that you had never been to in your life, it had this incredible draw on me. When I landed back in LA, I felt like I was in a foreign land, even though I spent the majority of my life in Los Angeles. And it just felt really incredible that you could go somewhere like that, that you had never been to, and had this incredible connection to it that you would have never thought of, you know?
It's crazy to learn that Toxicity hit number one on September 11th, 2001, especially considering what transpired with you personally after that. And you admit in writing in the book, I don't think that I'd ever felt more like a man without a country than in the days, weeks, and months after 9/11. When did that change for you, if at all, to where it did feel more like your country?
I mean, it felt like my country from a long time back. You know, it's just when you're in a democracy and you are afraid to speak the truth because of backlash, that's when you feel, you know, that's when you feel like that something's really wrong, right? And mind you, that coupled with growing up as an Armenian American in Los Angeles, paying taxes to a country that is not properly recognizing the genocide of our ancestors, a democracy not recognizing the proper history because of political expediency, because of Turkey being a NATO ally and they didn't want to recognize it, you know, just dirty political fucking geopolitics. That makes you an activist. You know, that made me an activist. It made me someone who fights for truth and justice, not just having to do with, you know, Armenians or Armenian issues, but many issues, you know, in the US, human rights issues around the world, and even animal rights, climate issues. You see the world of injustice. You see that imbalance, and you want to kind of tip the scales up because you know that that's going to make a world a better place in every way. And so, you know, I've always spoken truth to power, but only because I cared. If I didn't care, I wouldn't speak my mind, right? So that's what people, but unfortunately, because I wasn't born here, I got some shit after 9/11 for speaking truth to power.
Yeah, and look, it's hard to go against a public narrative, to speak what you believe to be the truth. It takes conviction to do that. And it also takes an understanding that you are going to face an enormous backlash potentially in return to. I don't know how much top of mind that was for you versus the raw emotion of everything that had just happened and what transpired leading up to that as well.
Now, that's the word. That's a good word, public narrative. Whenever the truth matches the public narrative, it's easy to speak the truth. For example, when George W. became unpopular years later, all musicians, all artists were bagging on him. And I'm like, where the fuck were you? And, you know, there was a handful of artists that had the courage to, you know, and to question his invasion of Iraq or all of the things that they did using 9/11 as a, you know, platform, as a springboard, really. And
Oh yeah,
you know,
wars, the Patriot Act. There are all sorts of ways they exploited that, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one thing that it's really hard when the public narrative is against what you're saying, and yet you still have to speak the truth. And it's actually more important then to actually tell the truth than
Yeah.
it is in any other case.
Completely agreed with that. Now, I love the stories of how toxicity and chop suey came to be. I'm not going to have you retell those right here. People just need to buy the book to learn about those. As far as chop suey is concerned, though, it was nominated for a Grammy in 2002. I'd forgotten that. You guys were actually invited to perform at the Grammys that year, but you and Darren decided not to. You say that looking back now, you'd tell your younger self to just go play the damn show. Why is that?
I don't know. For us, it felt like we didn't want or need someone else to pat us on the back and say, you're doing good kind of thing. It just felt very anti-punk rock, to be honest. And so it was a bit of, it was a bit of a, ah, fuck it, you know, kind of thing, you know, and we didn't get the Grammy for it, which is fine. We got a Grammy for BYOB a few years later,
yeah,
and we still didn't end up going or playing, to be honest. But you know, but in retrospect, the music industry is not big, that big of an industry. Like, and touring with these, all these different bands, and, you know, everyone goes to these events and you see people and you have a beer with them and you actually have a good time. And so that's what I meant. In retrospect, it would have been a fun time. Like, who cares, you know, win or lose. Like, so yeah, that's what I meant.
Well, it is interesting that you guys won a Grammy a couple years later, because I double checked this too with the digital copy. You mentioned it once and it was mentioned very fleetingly. And even the song itself, BYOB, was given just a paragraph or two. Does that Grammy really mean anything to you, Serge, in the end?
You know, I mean, awards are nice for a cabinet somewhere in the house, but it really, you know, it doesn't mean, I mean, it's nice. It's always nice when people like what you do. It's human to want that, you know, like be appreciated. That's cool. But does it mean anything? I mean, really? Nah.
So the Grammy's like a youth soccer trophy, just in a cabinet somewhere in your house.
It is. I've put it between my favorite books in my book cabinet. So
okay.
It's holding two sides of really great books. And
I think that's a great place for a Grammy.
It is. It is a great. It is between. It's holding the books, and it, so it's also utilitarian, right? It's not just symbolic. It's also. But my son the other day asked, "Wow, Dad, you've got all those awards," and he pointed to the Grammy. He goes, "What's that one?" And I said, "That's called a Grammy." And he goes, "Okay, and what's this one?" I said, "That's called a this." Like, and it was just interesting just watching him. And he said, "Do you have more awards?" I'm like, "Yeah, probably in some boxes somewhere." He goes, "Wow, you have a lot of awards." I'm like, "Yeah, but I also have a lot of guitars and those I can play."
Well, I've had to tell my kids, because we do play youth sports, and there have been a couple of seasons that they've lost in a championship game and they're so upset that they don't get that trophy. And I'm like, guys, understand trophies are little plastic relics that you've gone through the important part. That is the process. This is getting better. That's coming together with your teammates and forming friendships. Like, you got the important part of all of this. The trophy is a byproduct of all of that. Not a very necessary.
Yeah, you're like, did you have fun? Yes or no? I mean, that's what it is. You know, did you learn something? Yes or no? The rest is BS.
What does the song BYOB mean to you, though?
BYOB is a really good anti-war song, I would say, you know, but done in a humorous way. Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time, dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine. I mean, you know, but during the verses, you're talking about all these evil things done by governments, and in a very kind of, you know, there's certain biblical expressions, certain, you know, Iraq war memories kind of expressions and whatnot. It's a really well-crafted, I think, you know, Darren wrote the music to the song along with the chorus lyrics. And I basically wrote, a lot of other lyrics around it. And, you know, it's a strong song, I think.
You also say that Steal This Album, which is a nod to the Abbie Hoffman Counter culture classic, Steal This Book, which I actually have stolen a copy of Steal This Book.
Oh, wow. Look at you.
Yeah.
That's
along
cool.
with the single Boom are two of your favorite things that you've helped to create with System of a Down. Why are you so fond of those two things?
I'm fond of Steal This album because it is our most diverse record musically. It has songs on there, you know, in totally different uniforms, like just, you know, and it's one that I wouldn't mind playing, you know, from the first to the last at a concert. Like that would be fun to do as a record, as a concert experience. And Boom is important because we put out that song with a video directed by Michael Moore right before the Iraq War. And we fought with the label to get the funding to be able to do that video because we weren't just launching it as a single. We didn't want to do a single. The record company wanted us to put a single from Steal This album. And, you know, the songs from Toxicity were still on the radio. And we just felt like it would be, you know, not great for the band to oversaturate our music on the radio. So we said, we don't want to do a single. We want a political song and do a video for it and not have radio necessarily play it. And they're like, the fuck are you talking about? You know? And, but we fought to get that done. And we did. The video shows us in the LA protests leading up to the Iraq War, along with protests all around the world that, you know, there were 10 million or 10 million plus people protesting before a war even occurred, knowing that that's going to happen, that the US was going to attack Iraq on the fake WMD assertions and layer cake and all of that stuff. Everyone knew, people generally knew that it was bullshit, but it happened anyway in our name, you know?
Yeah. It's so difficult for artists, especially when they're new to the system, to fight for that creative freedom. But credit to you guys, you were not going to waver from your convictions. And ultimately, long-term, I think that served you very well. That just helped the overall respect that you had from the fan base. And it helped you guys to probably maintain a certain level of respect with yourselves too.
I think, you know, the message has always been important to me, because I was an activist before becoming an artist, and to System in general as well, System of a Down in general. Although, you know, there have always been pulls and pushes and pulls between the music and the message within the band. The guys kind of keep me in line, not overdoing with the message, and to make sure I don't forget that we're an actual musical band. yeah, so it's good.
So we're going to fast forward a little bit. I'm so appreciative of 45 minutes with you, but 45 minutes is not near enough time to get into everything within this book. But this book actually did start out as an idea of you sharing your philosophy on justice and spirituality, something you actually got to ask the Dalai Lama about in 2008, which is so freaking cool. Again, people need to get the book to read a little bit more about that story. But within these pages, you talk about something that I find fascinating and so important as well, called compassionate confrontation. Why is this concept so important to your overall philosophy of life, Serge?
It took me the majority of my life to kind of understand what that really means. And it's really a very hard practice to accomplish, because when something makes you angry, you want to react, right? And rather than finding the root cause of the other person's anger, and seeing all that through immediately and being able to find a solution rather than contribute to the problem. And that seems to be, you know, and it's kind of funny. They were teaching it in my son's class when he was like 4 years old, you know, because the kids, they love to bite each other and go, especially the boys, right?
Yeah.
If you have boys, you know this, that they love to go at it. And they were like, we're trying to teach compassionate confrontation. I'm like, wow, if you could teach a three-year-old that his life's going to be incredible, because I'm 57. I'm just fucking learning it now, you know?
Well, gosh, it's especially hard with your kids at times too. You and I have a daughter. You have a son who are 9 right now, born about a month apart. I've got a 7-year-old as well. Like, you can keep it up to a certain point, but they learn how to push their buttons where it becomes very difficult about 15 to 20 minutes into trying to solve a problem.
For sure. Yeah, it is difficult with kids. They, especially when they're, you know, they have a lot of passion. It's good that you got them in sports. They got to run around and get all that energy out. When my son was doing jujitsu, he was, you know, he was a lot more balanced emotionally, I think, because he had that, you know, he had that form that he had to comply with, and also all this exercise, all this energy that, you know, get tired, they're better. When they don't, I think it becomes even more problematic.
Oh, it's so crazy. I'm with you on that. And diet plays into that as well. And so does screen time, by the way. When you combine
100%
these hyper palatable diets that are high in junk carbs and sugars, and these kids laying dormant just staring at screens all day, and then going to school. Yeah. And look, there are some positives to the American school systems. There are a lot of shortcomings as well to the public school system, certainly here in Texas, where it's way too much rote memory and not fostering enough creativity and problem solving, and trying to grow somebody who is interested in learning. When you add the lack of physical activity into all of that, it's no wonder that we have so many attention deficit disorders that we're trying to deal with in this country, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I had a friend whose son was not sleeping through the night. I mean, up till age like 10, 11. And finally I go, have you tried, you know, they took him to therapists and this, that, and the other. They were considering giving him medicine, but they didn't want to, which is fair. And I just said, have you cut a screen for just a week?
Yeah.
Like, have you just tried? And they hadn't. And when they did, he slept, you know? And I'm like, fuck, dude. Like, it's right there in front of you, you know? It's like, not that you have to cut it forever, but at least you know what the cause is. You know, it's so encompassing, especially with kids, and it's really dangerous.
Moderation is so important in so many different areas of life, and certainly that one. So speaking of parenthood, since we're on the subject, you did have your son, you and your wife, Angela, by the way. Good to know that there is a second blonde-haired, long-legged Armenian out there, because I consider myself that as well. I'm guessing Angela has better legs than I do, though, Serge.
I'll be the judge of that. Show me the legs.
But how did that cause you to think differently about your creative endeavors, having a son?
You know, you just had less time. I think once you have a family, you actually have less time for everything, right? So you become more productive within smaller time periods that you actually have to create. But it made me more creative in the sense that I had this new love, right? Like this new being that I was in love with, you know, and that gave me a different kind of inspiration, you know. So that plays a part in it. But it changes you, as you know. Once you have kids, it changes you. It's no longer about you guys, but you know, it's also about how do we do this so that their future is secure and they're happy and we don't endanger them. As an activist, I've been a little more careful, although I'm still an activist and I say what I feel. But you know, it just, you have to think of everything. You have to be mindful of more things, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. Now, System has only played Armenia one time. The first time, the only time, was April 23rd, 2015, during the 100th anniversary of Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. What was that like for you guys getting to play that show in those conditions?
It was the top of the mountain for System of a Down, as far as I'm concerned. It was the kind of, if there was one event that we were meant or created to play, it was that night. And it felt that way. You know, it was raining. There were about 50,000 people in Republic Square. And, you know, they say it always rains, even though it's April, it always rains for the Armenian Genocide every year in Armenia. And I remember before we went up, we huddled and we couldn't believe we were there. Like, because it wasn't just playing a show and paying homage to our people there, but it was also paying homage to the 1.5 million who were massacred during the first genocide of the 20th century. And our own grandparents in particular, and their memories and their presence was really felt that night. I felt the presence of my grandparents heavily. And, you know, it was like this juxtaposition of these worlds, physical, spiritual, emotional, history, current, like all happening at the same time. So it became this really unique, one of a kind show and experience for us.
You went back to Armenia in 2017 with Anthony Bourdain. Yes, I am jealous of that for parts unknown. Was that as much fun as it sounds like it would be going someplace foreign with Bourdain?
It was, yeah. I mean, he was really kind to have reached back out when I reached out to him about going to Armenia. I kind of proposed it and worked with their producers to find the right people to talk to, restaurants to go to, that kind of stuff. And he was, I loved the fact that he was such a truth teller and so, you know, he's so punk rock. Like he was so punk rock. Like he loved music. He loved good music. He loved good food. He didn't deal with bullshit. And he spoke truth. I mean, for someone who's popular on TV, you know, talking head to be so truthful and honest and funny and his the way he spoke, the way he wrote, the way he writes his monologue, if you listen to Kitchen Confidential or his other books, it's remarkable. He was a remarkable writer. And so really good guy in person. We had a you know some laughs and some nice chats because he really authentically wanted to know about Armenia and you know and what made it tick and what was important. I remember his producers calling before the show and saying we're having problems with CNN's lawyers because he Anthony wanted to go to Nagorno-Karabakh, which was not a of an official country, you know. According to the UN at the time, because even though it's been Armenian lands for thousands of years, Stalin in 1920s had decided to cede that territory to Azerbaijan in the 1990s. Armenians won, you know, got their independence, an area that was majority Armenian and had held on to that until 2020 when Azerbaijan invaded again. And just last year, as you I'm sure know, it was depopulated of Armenians through ethnic cleansing by Azerbaijan, which is a major human rights catastrophe and something that needs to be taken to the International Criminal Court. But so he was going to go, and the lawyers were hesitant about it. So his producer said, "Can you give us some arguments why he should go?" And I basically said, "Look, if you want to understand modern Armenia, you have to understand three or four things. One, the devolution of the Soviet Union. Two, the large earthquake in Spidak that happened in 1998 that devastated everything. And three is the war in Artsakh. You know, if you don't understand those three things, you're not going to understand what makes Armenia tick now." So that's apparently all they needed. And Tony ended up going there. And, you know, I was incredibly appreciative. He was on a blacklist by he was blacklisted by Azerbaijan before his death, which really made me think. Yeah. So and when I remember having a conversation with him, I said, "Listen, if you go to Nagorno-Karabakh, I'm just giving you a heads up, you're going to get blacklisted by Azerbaijan." And I loved his response. He said something like, I'm putting it more, he said something ruffian, but I'm putting it more gently. He said something like being blacklisted by that guy or Putin or Erdogan in Turkey is a good thing. Like fuck them, you know, that kind of a thing. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. I loved seeing that. That's why I loved Tony. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that he's speaking truths like that to the bitter end. All right, last few questions now, Serge. First off, what do you love about America?
What I love about America is our enthusiasm. Enthusiasm to get things done. A feeling that anything can happen, you know. You know, we're not, because we're a younger country, I don't think we're burdened by history as much as many other European nations or countries around the world. We have this, you know, this can-do attitude. I love that. I love that about the US that makes it different. And I think it makes it really desirable for people around the world.
What do you love about making music?
It saved my life. You know, making music saved my life. It started out as a meditative practice, playing keyboards, my first instrument. And now it's what I get excited to do every day, either art or music, anything within the arts. It's what keeps me going. You know, it's like if I have physical pain and something's hurting so much that like I can't deal with it and I need to think of something positive, I think of creating music. I think of you know, literally, it makes me happy. That and coffee.
And do you have an Armenian coffee company now? Did I read that correctly?
I do. Yeah, we started Kavat Coffee in 2018. Kavat means cup in Armenian. And we're about to open up a cafe gallery in Eagle Rock, California. Within the next month or so, doing the build out now. But yeah, I've got a coffee company. It reminds me of, being at home with my mom and grandmother and them making coffee. The smell of the coffee in the air, it's just, I love that aroma. I love walking into a place and smelling coffee. It makes me feel great. So it started with that vibe, and I wanted people to learn about Armenian coffee.
Yeah,
People
what are the
don't
qualities
know.
of Armenian coffees? Because African and Latin American coffees have very distinct flavor profiles. So is there something that defines Armenian coffee?
Well, Armenian coffee is made in a cauldron the same way as Arabic coffee, Turkish coffee, Greek coffee, etc. But it's a little different the way the types of beans that are used and the way it's prepared. We don't do a very traditional Armenian coffee. We do a modern version of Armenian coffee because it's a taste that I like. I don't like it too bitter. So we have a and we use a full Ethiopian organic fair trade bean. And Ethiopia is the first place that coffee ever started in the world historically. And so, yeah, we have an Armenian coffee. We have a few different espressos and a decaf. Yeah.
Very nice. All right, last question now. What do you love about being Armenian, Serge?
That's tough. I love our culture and history is not just ancient, but it's way bigger than our numbers. There's only like what 8, 9 million Armenians around the world, but we have incredible artists. We've created the MRI machine. We've created color television. If you look at Armenian inventors, you see this huge footprint that Armenians have left on culture and history that's just unique and amazing. And I'm really proud of
I call us the poor man's Jews, and I am now proud to say that
that.
I have gotten to talk to two of my favorite Armenians in entertainment, Sam Tripoli, who've had the pleasure of getting to know over the years, and now Serj Tankian. His new book is so good, and I'm not just saying that as an Armenian, by the way. I'm saying it as somebody who just enjoys hearing a unique story, some really fascinating, informative life philosophies, and learning a little bit of history too about a very important event in Armenian and American history. The new book is called Down with the System, a memoir of sorts. And Serge has been nice enough to join me for close to an hour. Serge, thank you so much for the time today, man. It's been a real pleasure. And I know with the U.S. officially acknowledging that the Armenian genocide is a thing back in 2019, Biden talking about it as a president first in office, first time that's happened for a president in office in our history, that a lot of that has to do with the hard work of plenty of people prior to that moment, including you, my man. So thank you so much for all of those things.
Thank you so much, Trey. I really enjoyed our time and the conversation, and it's really good to meet you, brother. I appreciate that.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. Thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time on Books on Pod.